You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, episode number 57. What you should know about risk-based monitoring. An interview with Tim Rolfe. Welcome to the Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector designed to improve your leadership skills, widen your business acumen, and enhance your efficiency. If you're not already doing it, follow me on LinkedIn to get much further updates on all kind of different things related around becoming an effective statistician. Today we are speaking with Tim Rolfe. He's an expert on risk-based monitoring and also pretty passionate about it, so we will learn a lot about the increasing important role of risk-based monitoring in clinical development. And of course, we will talk about also this being a career option for statisticians. Finally, we will give you an insight what you need to know as a study statistician about risk-based monitoring. So stay tuned for this one. This podcast is created in association with PSI, as always, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the special interest groups, the video on demand content library, very good actually, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. And you get that for just £20 for non-high income countries and only £95 for high income countries. If you wonder what the pound is, that's about the same as for dollars or euros. Just visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the podcast, The Effective Statistician. Here, this is Benjamin Pieske speaking, and I'm here today with Alexander.
Hi, Benjamin. How are you doing?
And Tim Rolfe.
Hi, Tim. Everyone.
Tim, well, I mean, probably I just ask you to introduce yourself, please. Maybe we have a nice topic today, but I think the easiest to really get into this topic is if Tim is introducing himself, please.
Sure. So, hi everyone. I'm Tim Rolfe. I am a statistician by training, but I'm currently working as director of risk-based monitoring and centralized monitoring at GSK. I've been a statistician at GSK for just over 20 years now, and over those years, I've had quite a broad range of experience through drug development, and I found that RBM has been my most recent challenge.
Okay, awesome. But you also have another role, and that is at PSI that you're working on. What's your role there? What do you do there?
So I'm currently membership secretary at PSI. So I sit on the board of directors, and my responsibility is to go through and try and ensure that we have year-to-year membership growth, reaching out to turn PSI into the leading global membership organization for statisticians and data scientists working in the pharmaceutical industry.
And how do you want to achieve that?
So our main goals are to show the value that PSI has to offer. You know, I've been involved in PSI for a number of years, and it's a great society to support statisticians and also, you know, anybody really working with data within the pharmaceutical industry. It's there. We have a huge range of scientific content supporting anybody that's doing data analysis, and really the growth is there to, as we're transitioning the strategy from being very kind of day focused courses to webinars and you know, outreach content that's available, you know, across the globe. So, you know, I think we have a huge amount of materials that we've already developed as we've kind of strengthened our position across Europe. But, you know, with the web technology You know, we can make that available via kind of electronic e-learning type materials. So it doesn't matter where you sit within the world. You know, if you're interested in learning more about the analysis of pharmaceutical data, then you know we hope that PSI is kind of the society that you would join to really support your development.
And how could you join PSI? How does it work?
So yeah, in terms of the membership, PSI, we have our website, which is psiweb.org. And there's a nice join here button on that. Membership, it's an annual membership, which comes in at, I think, is a very reasonable rate for those who are employed within the industry. For those who are students or academics, we can support them too as they develop their skills. We offer free membership to full-time students and also to teachers. So those that are teaching younger, you know, mathematic type students who may have an interest in the pharmaceutical industry. So we offer free membership to those so that, again, they can learn about the industry and what it offers to younger students as they're trying to figure out what their careers may be as they go through, you know, decide what university courses they're likely to be doing. We also offer reduced rate membership for anybody that's living and working in you know, lower cost countries, and we map that to the World Economic Forum criteria. So they have a long list of what they call their high income countries, and if you're not in that list, then you're eligible for a low rate, which comes in around £20 UK, and obviously that translates, but we think, you know, actually with all the materials that we've got to offer with the membership, it gains you access to the Pharmaceutical Statistics Journal, and as I say, all of our online content plus webinars, so we think that actually it's a very good value investment.
Awesome. Very good.
Sounds very good. Yeah. And just one last question regarding PSI. So when you say you're aiming for like a world leadership in the statistical community, let's say. So what does PSI differentiate then from others? So kind of as a competitive thinking.
So I think it's our very specialist, because we are purely pharmaceutical industry focused, and we support, you know, anybody who's doing data analysis within the pharma industry, and it's that laser focus on kind of the industry topics that really makes us special. If you look at the US, there's the DIA, or there's the ASA Biopharm. But you know, the Biopharm unit is one part of ASA, which is a much larger organization with, you know, broader focus. So really, I think, you know, that is our key feature. It is, you know, everybody that's involved within PSI is you know, dedicated to the support of development of you know, medicines within the pharmaceutical healthcare industries.
Yeah, and I think the other point is it's highly organized. It has a very, very efficient way of delivering content. There's a very, very good back office that helps all the volunteers to actually focus on the content stuff and take away lots of the logistics and organizational work, which makes it a lot of fun to work within PSI as a member and contribute. So that's my personal experience with PSI and why I got more and more involved into PSI. Okay, but now let's stop talking about PSI and let's start talking about the topic of today, which is RBM as a short form for risk-based monitoring. So how I my current understanding of risk-based monitoring, and then please correct me in that and expand on that, is that you basically, we have moved away from kind of monitoring every kind of single data piece within a clinical trial and checking everything against source data to looking into, okay, what are the data points that have the biggest impact and where are the sites that maybe struggle the most and focus monitoring in that regard, and by that reduce the overall monitoring costs for clinical trial dramatically by still having a good kind of overall quality. So basically cutting out all the monitoring on you know, low risk, good quality kind of part, and more focusing it towards the risky areas that have a big impact. Is that kind of a overall good description of risk-based monitoring, or how is that completely?
Yeah, so the way that I look at risk-based monitoring is actually it's fundamentally quality management, and that's how it got laid out within the updates to the ICH GCP guidance, which actually sits as part of their quality management framework. Really, I think you summarized it nicely in terms of the way I think about it is that our monitoring resource is incredibly expensive. Sending people, you know, around the world to visit the sites is very costly. And really what we're trying to do with RBM is be efficient as we can be in terms of targeting the areas of highest risk. I see it as quite an end-to-end process. It starts when, you know, when the protocols are being developed, thinking through, you know, what are the risks associated with the protocol that we're designing. And usually, from my experience, whenever we've done early risk assessments, sort of if we were looking at this 5 years ago, all the risks would be focused on, you know, what are the risks that we're not going to meet our recruitment milestones? What are the risks that we're not going to get the data in time and we're not going to, you know, and it's always been milestone driven. What are the risks that we're not going to deliver? Whereas actually RBM is focusing on the, what are the risks within the data that we're capturing? Let's make sure that we have the best possible quality data for the data that's really matters. And obviously, you know, the ultimate risk that we're trying to manage is when that data gets to reviewed by regulatory agencies, the FDA, etc. But actually, they don't start finding, you know, holes within the data that lead to, you know, worst case, a rejection of a file because, you know, they inherently don't trust the data that's being presented to them. So the way that RBM works is, you know, it starts off with that risk assessment, and really that should, my belief is that should be done very early stages when you're starting to talk about the concept of your protocol. Identify, you know, it's not just what's the primary endpoint, but, you know, it's what's the patient population that we're after. Obviously, you know, if you design a protocol with you know, loosely defined inclusion exclusion criteria, what's the risk? Well, if we enroll a patient that doesn't have the disease of interest, well, that patient's unlikely to benefit from you know, any treatment we give them. But there's obviously going to be the risks of side effects from giving somebody an investigational product. So you know, it sits there around you know, making sure that we've got the right population that we study within our trials. Once you get through that piece, you know, making sure that you know, we're getting accurate and reliable data within our trials. Now, historically, that, you know, we looked at the accuracy by getting our CRAs to go to site and do 100% source data verification, i.e. they do 100% check of, you know, what has been written in the source notes, does that match what we've got in our case report forms? And we'd say, okay, by doing those 100% checks, we're getting accurate and reliable data. But actually, across the industry, we know that that wasn't true. We'd still get audit findings when our own internal quality assurance groups, or when, you know, external agencies, EMEA, FDA, PMDA, etc., go out and audit the sites. We know that there's still issues at sites. So we got ourselves hung up on spending, you know, vast amounts of money, and you know, some of the findings that. The Transcelerate group, and I'll come on and talk about those a little bit more later, but they did some research into the impact that SDV was having on data quality. And they estimated, actually, we were spending around a third of the study budget on monitoring costs.
Well, if you think about kind of the how much studies costs, that is a huge amount.
It is.
So. If you think about, you know, a couple of these phase three studies cost, you know,
hundreds of millions, 200,
hundreds of millions. And, you know, that way you can, you know, with just implementing this quality approach, you can spend, you know, you can save hundreds of millions of dollars.
Now, I need to be, I'm always a little bit cautious when I'm talking to my colleagues about the money savings, because when RBM first came out, there was this really big thing of you're just going to do less monitoring. And actually, for some trials, yes, that's probably going to be the case. But in other trials, you get the, but why is our monitoring gone up? Well, it's because actually we're identifying more risk. And therefore, you know, the way that I try and do it is, actually what we're trying to do is stop the escalating costs of monitoring. You know, we got to a point where it's crazily expensive, but it's increasing incrementally. And we want to stop that. So actually, you know, some trials are going to cost more, because if you're finding problems and you have lots of issues at a lot of sites, then actually you're going to send your monitors out more, because those sites need some handholding. And I see it as that. What we're doing is we're analyzing the data in stream, and then we're sending our staff out to support those sites that may be struggling to understand the protocol, or maybe struggling to get the right patients, or, you know, maybe they've misunderstood something and they just need some additional training. But by sending out our monitoring organization to the sites that need it, then, you know, that's how we increase our quality, and we minimize that risk of having a final data package that goes to submission that then gets scrutinized and gets devalued because, you know, they find quality issues within it.
And that is, of course, also a pretty big cost saving. You know, if you would need to rerun a study because you failed on the quality side, that's huge cost thing in terms of the study itself.
But only a potential.
Yeah, it's a potential cost saving.
Only a potential cost saving. You know, there are very high profile cases out there where, you know, studies have been discounted from quality and, you know, it fails to get a drug approved. Now, if you don't get the drug to market on your first pass, and then you get into that you know, cycle of, you know, resubmitting data, reanalyzing, you know, worst case, you have to run a whole new study to replicate the findings, then, you know, as you say, not only is it the cost of the additional research and work, but it's the loss of income from, you know, time on market. So, you know, there's huge implications there around getting the highest quality data package that we can to support our drugs. I see it as, you know, we focus vast amounts on getting it to market quicker. But if we do that at the expense of quality, then actually that may be, you know, a false positive, because, you know, if you get there and then you lose all this time during the review cycles, then, you know, we've not actually gained anything.
So we already mentioned that this is obviously playing a big role and a lot of advantages, either and cost savings or potential cost savings for phase three studies. But are there other studies where risk-based monitoring plays a role like this?
Sure. Now this is one that kind of gets contentious, because there's a lot of different thoughts in there, whether, you know, should we be doing risk-based monitoring on early studies, or is it something that's only really suitable for later phase larger trials? Now, And I think it falls into a couple of areas. My personal belief is I think that we should be taking a risk-based approach to all of our trials. So, you know, identifying what are the critical data, what are the critical processes, you know, how is the data that we're capturing created? Make sure that is, you know, especially for the critical stuff, the stuff that you know, is going to lead to approval, you know, so core primary endpoint, making sure that we don't have, you know, excessive amounts of missing data. Patient population, making sure we don't have excessive amounts of protocol deviations. Safety data, make sure that our safety data is being captured accurately and reliably, and you know that there's no misreporting or missing safety signals. You know, that worst possible case for us is to get a drug approved and then later find out that actually we missed the safety signal. So in terms of getting those pieces together, you can, you know, start thinking about that at the beginning. So once you define what's critical, focus in on that. I always get into arguments with my colleagues. You know, we have our primary endpoint and our core safety, and we'll then have some secondary endpoints. Well, but they're really important, and we've got them in a hierarchy because we want to get them into our label. Okay, so yep, some of those are probably critical. And then we've got all these tertiary endpoints, but they support it. Yeah, but they're tertiary endpoints. You know, why are we getting our monitors going out and checking every single one of those? Does it really, really critical to the success or failure of a drug? No, it might help, but it's likely we're going to fall back onto those if you know, our primary endpoint's not quite as robust as we would have liked it to have been. So let's make our primary endpoint robust and spend a little bit less time checking all of those. You know, there may be some really important con meds, but it's every single con med important?
Yeah, and these can be very, very long lists in some disease areas. And sure. You spend a whole load of money and looking into all kind of things that, you know, the physician put in there, and being it, mm-hmm. you know, things that are completely uninteresting. And to be honest, in terms of concomitant medications, I know a couple of important things, but sometimes these have even kind of special questionnaires or special forms to capture them specifically. Yep. And, you know, all the other things, oh my God, you know, it's
yeah. And in terms, you know, in terms of comments, and also in, you know, in terms of some of the safety information that we capture, you know, especially we know how many cases of headache, how many cases of nausea are you going to get, especially in a large trial. When we're checking that, do we need to check every single line item for you know, every single data point? We capture vast amounts of data, but you know, yeah. What's important? The important is, they've had an event. When did it start? Did it resolve? Do we need to check down every single minute detail for the con meds? It's important, you know, if they started taking a beta blocker, what's important about that? Well, they started taking a beta blocker. Okay, that's important to know. Why did they start taking it? Do they have an AE that's associated with that? And well, surely they must have. If they suddenly started taking a beta blocker, you don't take those for fun. So let's check the SDE, the AE. And if there's nothing there, that's a potential safety issue that we may have missed. Those are the important ones. Yeah. An SDV does not pick that up. If you think about it, SDV is that check to say, okay, it says that they've started taking a beta blocker. I've got a beta blocker in my CRF, check. Tick that and move on. That doesn't really address the quality. So the way that that RBM has gone is to shift from that SDV to a concept called source document review. And the SDR is a more holistic review of the data for quality. And it's taking that step back and saying, actually, you know, doing those like-for-like checks, really, we know doesn't add value. But it's that check of, does the data that I'm seeing make sense? You know, so they have started taking a beta blocker. Do they have that AE or an SAE to go with it? And if they don't, you know, that's an important quality issue in my mind.
So just speaking about quality, you know, quality is, of course, you know, I see quality not as a kind of binary yes, no kind of question. I would see quality more as a kind of probably continuous variable. And so in order to, you know, measure quality, how do you come up with kind of good quality margins or something like this that, you know, defines where you, you know, invest more into your monitoring or where you kind of say that everything is kind of okay?
So, yeah, I think the FDA produced some guidance back in around 2013, so a good 5-6 years ago now. And one of my favorite quotes out of that is, quality isn't defined by the absence of errors, but the absence of errors that matter. And I think that is the fundamental. And as statisticians, you know, I think as a collective group, we've been guilty of the, well, this isn't right, we must correct it. And actually, well, what RBM framework is that we've acknowledged that this is right. We've looked at the risk that that carries. If it's an isolated data point that's wrong, then, you know, what's the impact and leverage on our analysis? And as statisticians, we need to think about that. It's probably low, and therefore single isolated incidents, acknowledge that you've seen it, you've performed a risk assessment of it, and the appropriate mitigation. That appropriate mitigation was, okay, we'll accept this. This is an isolated error. We have our little error term at the end of all of our models. We can manage that. You know, we can statistically manage out random error. The bit that's really important to us is the systematic error, you know, and that may be an entire site, you know, where a site has misunderstood the protocol, and therefore, you know, they've miscalculated, especially with, you know, some of the more complex rating scales that we use. You know, where they're having to do data manipulation. If they've miscalculated that and they do that across all of the patients, well, that entire site data may be biased. Or worst case, we may have to exclude it from our analysis. And so that impacts that, you know, our probability of success, or power, as we used to call it. You know, those are the things that are really important to us in terms of getting the quality right. And I think, you know, changing that mindset from the we have to fix everything to the is it important? What's its impact? And actually acknowledge, document, and move on.
Yeah, I can imagine that the discussion around like what is important, what points, or, you know, is really depending on the eyes that I look into this. So this different stakeholders that are, you know, giving input to a study or to the design of this. So, because meaning, you know, what is important is for one is, you know, it's safety, for the other it's effectiveness, for the other is, you know, whatever. So you look at this from a technical point of view, but who else is involved in the you know, as a statistician, I mean, you look into this as, you know, from technical point of view and looking into defining the risk and quantifying the risk and giving input there, monitoring it maybe. But who else is giving input as a stakeholder to the decisions of how RBM is being performed during this?
I think, you know, the risk assessment, that fundamental foundation of the process has to be, you know, cross-functionally, it is the study team, because, you know, you're going to need your clinician, your medical monitor, you're going to need your safety physician. You know, they're key to the, you know, what does this really mean to the patient? You're going to need your local country knowledge. You know, some of the things that we're looking at, you know, it may be that actually that, you know, that's just normal medical practice in our country. It may be a problem for the study as a whole. And therefore, actually, the study team then need to sit and weigh up that risk and the impact of that on the quality. You know, worst case, it may be retrain that country to say, actually, this is what we need. We know that that's your local practice, but, you know, we need to change that. It may be protocol amendment or even worse, the impact for operations. It may be, we're really sorry, we can't use your country because that's not going to meet the necessary requirements we need for filing this drug in the other countries that we're that we're looking at in our other markets. So there's a lot of challenges there that, you know, and it really does need that collective team input into the risk assessment and also the risk mitigation decisions. It doesn't sit with one role specifically. So again, as you say, as a statistician, we're perfectly there to assess the risk and quantify and the logical thinking patterns that we have as statisticians is perfectly aligned to try and help the other members of the team to weigh that up. You know, we've thought about risk for many years as part of our training. And we do have to change the mindset. I found, especially in the early stages when I was working on RBM, that we would be met with the mindset of the, you know, yes, there's a risk, we have to fix it. And moving people's mindset to the, oh, maybe we don't, maybe we can accept this. It makes people very uncomfortable. And it's understandable because it's a huge shift in the way that we have gone as a business. We have moved to be so conservative, and the regulators have played a part in that. You know, going through ADCOMS where, you know, the data gets scrutinized down to the very minutest detail. I think it's had something to do with it. So it's been really reassuring that both the FDA and the EMEA, you know, have their guidance. They, you know, PMDA, I think, are also bought into the concepts of RBM, but I'm not sure they have their specific guidance out yet. But, you know, the leading players within the regulatory industries have bought into this as a concept. You know, they agree that scientific research was getting too expensive, and actually we'd gone too far, the pendulum was swung too far in one direction in terms of trying to correct everything. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, we're on a course correct for the industry where actually let's target on what's really important and get that right.
So from my point of view as a statistician, if I think about it, there's a couple of key tables usually that you make the decisions at the end on, and that really drives the conclusion of your overall study. Mm-hmm. And these would be, and every data point that goes into these tables, these would be kind of my focus data points that I would look into, and look into what's the risk associated with these.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, as you say, you know, different companies do things in different ways, but you know, we normally have that headline data package, the bit that every instantly hones in on when we release the results, and as you say, you know, 5-10 tables at most are the ones where you will make that you know, that initial assessment. You may then get into the and what's all the supportive, especially when, you know, if your results aren't as strong as you thought and you get into that gray area, then, you know, you'll fall back. But again, that fallback position, that data, you know, as long as it's aligned, but it doesn't have to be held to the same level of scrutiny as you know, your key decision-making information for a go, any no-go decision.
Yeah, but it sounds easier than it is. I mean, 5-10 tables. I mean, just imagine like a rhesus criteria for oncology. What data is behind that in terms of just giving, you know, being presented in one of the key tables? So I think it's really, there's a lot of, I can imagine there's a lot of data behind that needs to be checked or you know, pointed to content of quality or risk in order to get these 5-10 tables.
Yeah, of course.
You know, on a higher level of quality.
Certainly is, and you know, but again, in thinking about the concepts of, you know, nowadays lots of our endpoints are taken from blood samples. Now, what's important about that blood sample? Because actually, what is there for to be checked in terms of quality? There's actually very little, because the blood gets drawn, it gets stored, shipped, analyzed, and we get the data in-house. There's no scope, or very little scope, for human error in that process. Where the human error may come in And this is where, again, SDV really falls down, and we need to change that concept, move over to the SDR concept of, you know, what are the processes that are important with lab samples? You know, it's the that blood draw, you know, make sure the sample's been taken. But once it's been taken, what's really important, it's got to be stored correctly. It's got to be packaged and shipped. The worst case is, you know, if they've shipped a series of samples in the wrong storage conditions, when it arrives to the lab, and, you know, an entire block of patient samples are, you know, non-analyzable because they've hemolyzed in transport, you know, that's a vast amount of patient data that's wasted. But in real terms, think about the patients. This is patients that have just sat there, had needles put in them, and we, as a research industry, have let them down because actually we've taken the bloods and they're of no use to anybody because we didn't handle that correctly. So, you know, those are the focus, the quality pieces that I think we really need to focus on. It's to do with how the data is generated, not just the data itself.
So in terms of data, let's move a little bit away from the, let's say, core clinical data that lots of statisticians are used to work with for their analysis of the medical questions. I think you work more personally with some metadata to assess risks, to look into quality and things like that. So what kind of data are you personally looking into as a, let's say, RBM statistician?
Yeah, so it, as you say, looking at quality, we you know, there is a focus on the clinical data, but there's also a lot of looking at site performance. So looking at the operational characteristics to see whether, you know, does it look like the sites are struggling maybe to meet the demand of the patients, you know. So a lot of metadata. I think the piece where it really comes into play is looking at the potential for fraud detection. And this is where the statisticians really have a key role in doing that analysis. And this is how I really first got an interest in monitoring. One of the very first studies that I worked on way back, when I first started postgrad, had a site where we did the analysis at the end of the trial, and every single person on the active drug responded. Every single person on the placebo didn't respond. And that response rate was, it was binary. And it just looked so completely out of kilter with every other site. This was in a neuroscience compound where we know placebo response rates are massive, and therefore it just stuck out like a sore thumb. And so, you know, I then spent 3 months looking at the data and analysing it to try and see what's different about that site, because, you know, worst case, we were kind of going, does this concern us enough? Because we're going to have to send out the auditors to this site, and we want to know, you know, what else is wrong with this site. Turns out there was nothing wrong with that site. It just happened to be that statistical
random chance.
Yeah, that statistical anomaly. But we got into really mining that data. Now, we did that retrospectively because we found a problem when we came to the analysis. That's not logical. That's not sensible. You know, with back 20 years ago when we were doing that, well, the data was paper, so it wasn't coming in real time. Computing was much, much slower. Nowadays, we've got so much computing power, and our data comes in almost real time, that we can be doing this sort of thing in stream, you know, and we can set the algorithms up and running. It's not like, you know, it's much, much simpler now to do these sort of checks in balance. Now, we're not looking at the efficacy, obviously. We don't want to do anything that risks jeopardizing the blind to a trial. But, you know, there are other areas that we can look at, sites that have abnormally high, you know, reporting rates. Things like, you know, if patients are using e-diaries, looking to make sure that those e-diaries are being filled out. If they're filled out, you know, sequentially, but too perfect. And you know, we've seen cases the regulators use these kind of methods as well to identify, you know, actually, you know, if the patient fills out their diary at 7 o'clock every day, well, that might be because they're very, very disciplined and they've set an alarm on their phone and that's what they do. But if every patient at a site does that, you know, no, that's starting to smell a little bit fishy to me, and I'd want to do a little bit more digging. And when you combine that with then, oh, and all their lab samples are all a little bit, you know, they don't have the same variability with respect to all the other sites. And, you know, these are the things where, you know, by combining multivariate analyses of the data, and it's more looking at the data patterns. It's not looking, you know, we're not trying to do formal data analysis to try and look at any efficacy response. All we're doing is looking at site-to-site variability for a lot of what we do. And identify those sites that are looking different. And by doing that in stream and identifying the sites early that may be a little bit different, then, you know, we can go out and this is, again, talking about the quality, we can get our monitoring organization out there to check to see whether, you know, is there a reason why that site is different? And then there may be very valid reasons. It may be a specialist center, whereas everybody else is just general practice. You know, and you do get these niche research centers where, you know, you've got a very homogeneous patient population that come in. But better that we know that up front than you know, the hours that I spent having put submissions in and the regulatory questions come in and you're suddenly they've found something in the data that we weren't aware of because we'd not looked. And you know, as an industry, I think we've got to move beyond that point of being very reactionary to let's be proactive about our quality. You know, that there are enough tools out there, and since the introduction of the ICH GCP revision, you know, there are plenty of vendors out there that have developed very, you know, nice, clever, easy to use software packages that will start to look at this site to site risk. GSK, we developed our own, you know, and others did. But, you know, there are, you know, companies out there that provide solutions as well to really hone in on the which sites look different. Okay, if they're different, let's go out there because actually, you know, there's a risk that there may be problems and we need to know about that up front rather than, you know, be caught out during the regulatory review.
Yeah. So I think we talked a lot about kind of the benefits for the study statisticians. Because if you have good quality data, all the analysis becomes much easier and you have much less kind of headaches in terms of robustness and sensitivity analysis and all these kind of things. So as a statistician, it's really important to have a good understanding of RBM. So where can people learn more about RBM?
So I guess, as I mentioned already, you know, there's a series of RBM guidance from both FDA and EMEA and section 5 of the ICH E6 R2, the GCP guidance, lays out that entire quality management framework. And you know, and it talks around the concept of statistical analysis of the data in stream. So you know, those are the very high level overviews of the kind of things that you need to consider. If you want to get into more detail, then Transcelerate have published that. For those of you that aren't familiar, Transcelerate are a not for profit organization that have set up. It came out of the Simplification of Clinical Trials Initiative that was run with the FDA, EMEA, and pharmaceutical sponsors. Their work has looked
And we had actually an episode about that.
Oh, brilliant!
So if you just scroll back a little bit in your podcast app, you'll find an episode about Transcelerate and some hints for statistics.
I love what Transcelerate have been doing to try and you know, standardize bits that we have to do as an industry. And you know, we've been really guilty of you know, within the industry, of we each develop our own solutions and they're all slightly different. And the more that we can standardize and be efficient, you know, they do lots of things. RBM was one of the first because obviously the costs of monitoring were, you know, vast, and therefore when somebody says you can make huge savings in your monitoring and that's a third of your budget, then, you know, everybody sat up and listened. But, you know, they're looking at, you know, sharing placebo data so that we can design more robust, you know, more informed trials. They're looking at an investigator platform so that instead of, you know, they need to log on to the GSK portal or to the AZ portal or the Pfizer portal, and they're working on, you know, they're working with six different sponsors, so they've got six different portals and six different passwords. You know, let's have one standardized portal that they log in and they can see everybody's. But, you know, so it's there to collaborate as an industry, and they're doing great things. But yeah, one of their first things, as I say, was looking into RBM, and they've got a huge set of support materials all around the concepts of, you know, support for, you know, what is SDR and why it's important, and they did all the research and they published that online, so you know, it's all out there within the scientific literature, as well as you know, you can see the highlights on the Transcelerate webpage. So yeah, if you
yeah, and we'll add all these links to the show notes, so just go to theeffectivestatistician.com and check out for this episode, and then you'll see all the show notes. So very, very easy. And you can also just go to your podcast player and go in the links there, so very, very easy to find there.
Perfect.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Tim, for the very valuable and informative interview. And yeah, with that, have a nice day, everyone.
Have a nice day. And listen and talk to you again next week on the next episode of The Effective Statistician. Bye.
Bye.
This show was created in association with PSI. Next week, we'll talk about a technical topic, the analysis of ordinal data. If you wonder what that is and how frequent it actually is and what you can do about it, keep listening. So, looking forward to speak to you next time. Thanks for listening. And as always, please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes, further resources about this episode, and to learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. Ciao!